is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at Appian World with Matt Hilliard, who's the Chief Product Architect for Appian, and we're going to talk about how Appian has architected its own product world. Matt, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is my first job out of college. I've been at Appian for over 20 years. I originally was in consulting, helping customers succeed with our product, and moved into product management over a decade ago. Today, I work on a lot of early stage R&D initiatives in a lot of different parts of our product. Here at the conference, it's been really great to see both the unveiling of things that I've been working on behind the scenes for a year or two, and especially to see customers getting value out of it and reaping the rewards of all the hard work.
There's that sort of proud parent moment, isn't there, when something you sweated on suddenly comes to fruition?
Yeah, totally. We really do sweat over these things and try to figure out what the best thing is. When you see it being successful, it's a really great feeling.
One thing that struck me this year, more so than any other year, is there seems to be a significant acceleration in the products and a significant integration of the various products. I think that really started when you announced Data Fabric several years ago, bringing it together. From your perspective as a product architect, is that because you started with a long-term roadmap that looks out 5, 10, 15 years to bring things together? Or what was the driving point to become a much more connected company?
I wish I could say that it's all just a 15-year plan. 10 years ago, I was like, okay, generative AI is happening here, so we got to be ready for that. It's a little more improvisational than that, but I think we have some consistent values for our product as a company that comes right from the top with Matt Calkins, our CEO. Having a really cohesive, unified platform is something that we really prioritize because in the industry, there's a lot of platforms that are unwieldy and combined, but only skin deep. For what we do, the sort of platforms that we provide and the experiences we want to deliver, it's really important for us to have that cohesion because the same user, ultimately, the same low-code developer or somebody building some kind of automation, ends up using a lot of the different pieces all at once. To use a consumer example, you might be a heavy user of Google Calendar, but not use Google Surveys very much. Whereas with our product, you mentioned Data Fabric. You're going to use Data Fabric, but that's only part of what you're doing. You're going to be using process automation. You're going to be using integration because you always have to integrate with other systems. So in order to be successful, you're going to want to use all those different experiences combined. We don't want your head trying to figure out how to do all that. We want everything to be consistent or as consistent as we can make it to keep the conceptual complexity as low as we can. That's something that's very important to us. The final point on that is part of the value there is a lot of times in big enterprises, you end up having the database team and they work just on the database. And then you have a front end team and you have to do things like that in a big company. You mentioned that we're trying to move fast, but we want our customers to be able to move fast and be able to get value quickly. We find that when we can empower a single team to solve their problems by putting at their fingertips what they need from data, from workflow, from interfaces, from integrations, and the same people can use all those things together, it's just so much more effective. You don't have to deal with different negotiations, different priority lists, because this might be your highest priority, but the database team has this other project that's really more important to them. That's why things can often take a long time. We really try to empower a single team to be able to succeed. That puts a heavy burden on us to try to make things unified, and we've been working hard on that for the last couple of years. It's really gratifying to hear you observing that.
I can go back to the mid-1980s when we started to see the idea of platforms on end-user development. Things like Smart from Innovative Software had a spreadsheet, a word processor, it had a display program, it had a communications program, and a language and a database. And it predated where Microsoft were, and it predated other people like WordPerfect. They did a really good job of integration. But most platforms out there, as you said, are quite disparate. People grab a new tool or they make an acquisition and they shoehorn it together. Did you set out to deliberately be fully integrated, or was it something that you reached a point and said, we need to take a beat, we need to take a step back on our product design, and we need to focus on integration rather than just kludging things together?
It's interesting that you point that out. We definitely take some inspiration from things like what you're talking about, like HyperCard. There was a time back in the 80s where we saw more of that, and then we got away from that as an industry. We always want to be as cohesive and integrated as possible. Sometimes when we want to move quickly and develop products quickly, it can be helpful for us to let a team go to town and not hold them back. part of what my job is to think about what's our overall conceptual architecture. Is this getting too difficult? Is this getting too complicated? Because that's the enemy for what we do. There's a little bit of an ebb and flow to it sometimes, but we still see big value in trying to achieve that simplicity. It comes from the business that we have been in for about 20 years doing business processes and process automation, where we realized early on, just from working with customers and seeing what kind of problems they had, that sometimes, for any given capability, whether that's managing documents, querying data, serving APIs, these days with AI, there's a lot of variation out there. Some people have their own in-house function that they built themselves. Some people have licensed a different product or service from another company. And then some people just didn't have it. When we had to say back 10, 15 years ago, oh, well, if you want to do this with data, you're going to have to go talk to some other company. And, you know, we'll work together with them. We're happy to work with other companies. Coming back to this idea of empowering a team to be successful, the fewer product acquisitions as a customer you have to make, the better you are. We realize there's a real value, as we see it, in having kind of a broad product that can handle people's needs, and again, in that tightly integrated way, without requiring to try to tie in other products. Of course, we're happy to still do that when they have a best-of-breed solution there.
I'll come back to that challenge of being an architect in a minute. If we go back again into that 80s, 90s, we moved from business process being something that was not a developer world. It was whole separate parts of the business. We hit business process re-engineering, and suddenly we started to think, how does this impact developers? How does this impact the architecture of the business in particular? But processes were slow. They were clumsy. They took a long time to put in place. But we had an acceleration of IT that outran our processes. Fast forward to today, and now processes are seen as much of a developer thing as they are a business analyst thing. More importantly, we have a challenge in that our processes often develop faster than we can code them, and we need to be able to absorb what people are doing with the developer tools and reverse that into giving us what our business process is. You sit astride both camps. When you're looking at this, how much now is looking at what the developer's doing and helping the developer turn that into a process and understand how that flows, as it is taking a traditional process world and enabling that to deliver software?
It's a great question. The process world has its roots in factory automation, Lean Six Sigma, those efforts going all the way back to Ford, Toyota, and all that. Definitely evolved as a discipline separate from software development. That didn't have to be that way. It's a little contingent that the major programming language paradigms of the 70s and 80s that are still influential today don't really have this idea that you have other kinds of control structures. We definitely, I like how you put it, that we have a foot in both camps, both in that we want to be able to speak to and work with what you might call a process professional, somebody who comes from that world of process optimization, like business process optimization. We want to be able to speak their language, but what we found is that the process concept, as we've distilled it over the years from leaning on those long roots of process optimization practices, was actually still a pretty big jump to go and take what people's on-paper process diagram and turn that into something that a computer could actually execute reliably. We had to figure out a lot of stuff a decade ago in order to really make that work well. But in doing so, what we found is this is actually a really beneficial way to think about software, to think about helping a business, to think about working with people, essentially. We get a lot of people who do come in and start using Appian with a programming background, but they get it really fast, like, oh, this new paradigm here that actually helps, to use technical language about this, raise the abstraction level, allow people to work faster, and then solve real problems in a way that's faster to build, it's easier to maintain than traditional programming. You also made an interesting point a minute ago about sometimes reality outruns the process. I would say that's very frequently the case across the enterprise. Even if it's not a process-centric view of the world, you have an enterprise system. You bring it in, hopefully makes some sense for you in that moment, but then things change. A year later, you have different needs. We think a lot about not just that initial implementation and how do you initially set something up, but how do you then continue to evolve and change? How do you adjust, both for agile software development reasons, which is that you never quite know what you want and you're going to experiment and figure it out, but also, even if you knew exactly what you want, then circumstances change, especially now with the way the pace of business and technology changing out from under everybody. what you did last year and what made sense for the software that operates your business last year might not make sense today. Making that as easy as possible is something else we have to think about a lot.
It's interesting because that splits into two camps around one group of technologies. We have low-code, no-code for enterprise developers, but we also have a massive shift to low-code, no-code for end-user developers, citizen developers. We promoted those citizen developers purely simply because one of the things we want to see is them writing what they need today. That goes all the way back to things like rapid application development in 91, 92. How do we get it out there faster? The problem is many of the older ones found that when it went back into the enterprise developer environment, yes, we've got the screens right, we know the process that the customer's using, or we've got the process that we know the end user is using, but that's not necessarily how the business thinks the process works. And we struggle to mix the two. Today, we don't have a choice. These people are outstripping us way faster than we can think about process. But you're an enterprise low-code, no-code company, not an end-user one. How do you square off that risk between the two, where you've still got people out here outstripping what developers are doing with your tools, and you've got to absorb processes created outside of your control and codify them into the core of the enterprise system?
That's a great question. We definitely think about that a lot. We get these trade-offs. We know from our customers, we hear from our customers all the time, that on one hand, it is very attractive. Like you say, business users solving their own problems. It goes back to what I was saying about not having to go to a different team. That applies even to business. If you need something and you can just do it yourself, that's great. It tends to be best for, frankly, simpler tools, simpler projects, simpler automations, just because at the end of the day, if it's a business person, if it's a citizen developer helping themselves, they've got another job. No matter how good the tools are, there's only so much complexity you can cope with if it's something you're doing as a tiny slice of your time. Of course, what can happen is that these things grow and become these Frankenstein things, and then IT has to pick up the pieces. It's when they get grumpy about shadow IT and all that stuff, which I understand. Separately, there's a need to standardize. There's a need to say, hey, we don't want each business user coming up with their own definition of when a customer is ready for this moment or whatever. We want to centralize and codify that. On one hand, as an enterprise platform, we have a lot of the tools that companies need to govern things, like an enterprise security model that makes sure that frees you to be able to give the access to data to the people who should have it without having to unduly lock it down, but also you don't have to worry about people getting into the wrong things or messing something up. But the challenge there, and it's also related to what we were saying earlier about changing over time, is to still be flexible. We think about how to enable IT to, first of all, do the things that IT is going to do best, like integration with different kinds of systems, setting up those security models I was talking about, and maybe setting up these core business rules and business processes that need to be codified. Because there's a lot of things for legal reasons, regulatory compliance, where you absolutely can't freelance. Has to be rigorous because it's the law. We could be accountable for that. We want to make sure that when you have that need to be rigid, we can provide that. But also, when you don't have to be rigid, let's allow people to flex the application and maybe solve some problems. An analogy I like to use, I think of these things as like an airplane. Avionics software that is running modern aircraft is extremely complicated, but it's also very rigorously quality controlled, and it must be miserable being a programmer developing that stuff because you have to just check everything a million times because lives are at stake. On the other hand, if you're the programmer who's working on the little game that kid can play on the TV on the back of the seat, we don't need to subject that to the same level of quality and rigor and FAA regulation. The same thing for these processes. We want to enable people to have the confidence, the rigidity that they need for when it's needed, but still be able to flex in order to be more fluid and able to meet the problems of the day.
One of the challenges with rigid systems, compliance-driven systems, is they're very rule-based. And historically, they've been a committee, looks at the legislation, comes up with a document, gives it to IT, who generally throw it in the bin after laughing, make a best effort, and that becomes the end of it. But a report last week showed that more and more companies are subject to 10 or more different types of compliance, with overlapping rules, overlapping controls, conflicting rules and controls. If we look at that from a process level, is there an opportunity here for Appian to look at building some form of compliance process tool where you're integrated with the compliance tooling? When rules are created, they're passed through as a process. And then when there is a conflict between two rules, or two processes as a developer's building something, you can give them a path out of that, or more importantly, you can highlight that what you're trying to do creates a conflict with this, this, and this.
It's an interesting question. So right now we do a lot in heavily regulated industries, and we have solutions that help accelerate people in those industries, things like government acquisition, financial services, life sciences. What you're talking about, I do see one reason that there's conflicting regulations, of course, is that we have customers who are operating in multiple areas. And so that's where you need what I would call the enterprise platform that's able to say, okay, when we're in Denmark, we have to do it this way, and when we're in Sweden, we're going to do it that way. That said, there's a lot of new possibilities that are opening up when we have things like generative AI. Usually these regulations are, I wouldn't call it natural language, but it's a slightly debased form of English or whatever the dominant language is. I've been talking to customers who are interested, because it's a moving target. As the regulations change, we have to figure out how to apply that to what we're doing. Maybe they were a little more optimistic. They didn't talk about running into conflicts like you were saying, but that definitely could happen. In the past, before we had things like generative AI, there wasn't much we could do about that. We just said, okay, look, you're going to get these new regulations, these new rules. Get your subject matter experts who understand this stuff, lawyers or policy experts. Get them in a room with the development team, and then we're going to try to make it as fast as possible. Make the development team as effective as possible. Once they get from the subject matter experts what they need to do, then they can turn that into adjustments to the process as quickly as possible. Now with generative AI, we're able to think a little more broadly about how to help leverage that in order to empower developers to move even faster and to give them the kind of insights you're talking about. So it's an exciting time.
Before I jump to that Gen AI, I'm going to come back to the architecture question. Architecting your own products allows you to create a landscape, your own frameworks, and make sure all the hooks are where you need them. It enables you to spot problems, to take action against those problems so that things are smooth forwards. We don't live, however, in a perfect world. We have to deal with other people. So the first question I have around the other people is mergers and acquisitions. Appian doesn't do a lot of acquisitions, but you have made some. When the company's considering something, are you pulled into those conversations? Do you get asked for your view on how does our architecture map to what that company might bring if we acquire them, and what sort of workload compromise would that give us?
I have been part of those conversations. We do think about that carefully because, like I said, the virtue that we strive for of cohesion and unification comes from the very top, from our CEO. While we have made a few acquisitions, we do that carefully and cautiously for that reason. And typically we do it when there's clearly a real, can't allow myself to use the term synergy, but a clear alignment in values and principles of how the products function. But inevitably, we do look at this closely before doing something like that. We definitely have to think about both technically, from the technical architecture of how things work, how that's going to function, and conceptually, how this fits in. Because we've done very few, we've only done it in the case where it's going to be a new capability that we have. There's not a lot of overlap with what we currently have. But we expect when we do something like that, it's just the beginning, not the end. When we make an acquisition, we have to then take the two products and combine them together, because that's our goal at the end of the day, is to have something that is simple and cohesive, and we work hard to make that happen. And it's not as easy as just, we paid this money, now we have this thing, now we can just go out there and sell it. No, we have to make it feel like a single authorial voice, even though there's a lot of contributors who are building different pieces of it, so that it's as easy as possible for people to understand.
One of the other advantages of you having this nice controlled environment is that your peers in customer world out there don't. They are constantly having to battle between, do we buy a platform, do we buy best of breeds, how do we architect this together? And the speed with which software and our architectures have changed over just the last 10 years, let alone the last 15, 20, 25, has created a real problem for them. We're only just starting to see the return of the enterprise system architect into a lot of companies. Where do they begin to start when they're effectively acquiring multiple products from people and trying to build a platform for their business? What should they be thinking about?
Our perspective on it is that we just take it for granted. Maybe there's somebody out there that has managed to just completely standardize in some way, but we expect and just accept that there's going to be a range of products, a range of technologies in play at a customer. We've invested very heavily in our ability to integrate, to play nice, to make it as easy as possible to work with other products, other technologies, and direct integration capabilities. We want to make sure that we're never the issue. We can conform to whatever API or authentication scheme or what have you that another technology the customer has might use. You mentioned Data Fabric at the beginning of this. That's our technology that connects data from across different data sources. When we were building that, one of the situations we had in mind was in cases where you have data where there's a lot of friction to changing the schema of data or to adapting it, and can we free an application or an automation project from having to fight with other stakeholders of that data, of the data stewards or what have you? How do we give them tools to be able to accept the data as it is and then leverage it successfully with our product? We think a lot about that. Your original question was what advice I would have for customers. My self-serving answer is there's never going to be a world where, like you say, you can turn into a walled garden where everything is just one way. Think about what the strategy is for empowering teams to still be able to be somewhat autonomous, be able to own the solution to something. We think we've got a great story around that. We've heard a lot of great things from customers about that as well, from deploying those things.
You've partly answered my next question, and that's about integration. Whether we like it or not, we have to play nice. As you said, you focus on trying to play nice. But the methods, the techniques, the way we talk to other systems, no two people do it the same way. APIs have simplified it. But for many customers, their challenge is that the vendors come along and all want you to work slightly differently. Some will invest in providing you with utilities or with pre-built integrations into other products. Some won't. It all depends on the size of the tool you're using. And it's always that small vendor tool that you're critically bound to that nobody else wants to help you build an integration for. How do we improve integration? Take yourselves as a solid platform that's highly integrated internally. How do we improve that external integration? Become almost Rosetta Stone-like when it comes to integrating?
At times, we have had the goal, or we tried to take steps in the direction of allowing users of our platform to, we said, okay, we're going to present to you a facade that hides all of those details behind it. So you have, for example, one way of interacting with data, and you don't have to even know how the data is stored and so forth.
So it's the whole black box approach.
We prize simplicity and ease of use in a way that a lot of other products don't. It was attractive to us to try to say, hey, we want people to bring us in because they like our way of doing things. Let's try to do that for them. In the end, it's an example of we have to turn around and accept it matters what the other system is. Yes, there's these two APIs, but this one performs much better than that one. And so you really can't just pretend they're the same. You have to be thinking about that. Instead, we have a more of a white box approach to integration where we accept that we can't hide all these details and it's probably not advisable to do so. We just try to deliver a set of tools that allow you to work with what you've got. You mentioned other products, but also customers have their own custom things, which often can be very idiosyncratic to deal with. Nevertheless, deeply embedded in the organization, we're not going to go and say that they can't use them. We need to be able to make that as easy to work with those things, but then also make it so that not everybody who is working on our platform has to have that expertise. Someone's got to. Like, the goal of nobody even has to know about the system, that was too far. But we do want to make sure that, because I think it's often the case, we have Bill and Janet over there. They understand this ERP system and everybody else doesn't. Okay, let's make it so that they can take what they know about it, package it up in such a way that now other people can leverage that and use it without these other people having to learn all the ins and outs of the system. Again, it's a developer empowerment thing to allow technical subject matter experts to serve a broader developer community within that customer.
Interestingly, Data Fabric's a really good example of that, the way you've decided to leave the data alone. Historically, we've grabbed data, we've munged data, we've put it in new places, created duplicates, and then lost our connections to it. But you stepped outside of that, we'll leave the data where it is and touch things, by now adding documents. How much has documents as a record and building a metadata layer made you rethink perhaps part of the architecture? Because this is now lots of tiny parts that are going to be constantly in movement in a lot of organizations.
I don't think that I quite agree that we've changed there. I think that our data fabric philosophy, just to articulate that, is that we don't force you to move your data into our system or even change anything about it. We want to work with the data where it is, and the system of record can stay wherever it is, and we're just going to work with it in that way. I'd love to say we were geniuses, but all it took was looking at various customers struggling with master data management and those kinds of efforts, The other thing that people do is they throw data over the fence to like a data lake or like some sort of read-only thing. Whereas, because we're a process company, we're interested in actual transactional data live down to the second. I see documents is still continuing along with that. So people can store documents in our system directly, but they can also integrate with external document management systems. We don't force you to move all the documents to a single place. Instead, we are providing what you might call an index. We don't use that term, but it's technically analogous to an index of document metadata, and then also semantic search, or smart search is our feature for that, but the technical term, semantic search of document contents, so that people can locate and cope with what often is an explosion of documents at these companies, but also still use our process orchestration capabilities to manage. We're creating a document, we're moving it, we're getting it approved, and all that stuff. I do see it as very continuous with how we've set up our data fabric architecture, and we've wanted to incorporate this kind of information, this unstructured data, for a while, especially with generative AI here, and so we're really excited to bring that to our customers.
I know we're short on time because you have to rush to get an aircraft. So I've got one last question, and I said I'd return to the Gen AI. Most companies coming into Gen AI are trying to work out how they architect it into their products. And it just sits as a separate entity. You've taken a wholly different view to the industry. You said, we're a process company. Our AI is going to sit in the process. Does that massively simplify your architecture of using AI? Or does that bring other challenges that you're going to be looking at over the next couple of years?
The biggest challenge that it meets is one that I think we hear from customer after customer, which is they're just not sure where to get value out of AI and how best to use it. For the last couple of years, as an industry, people have been looking at generative AI and saying, okay, where can I use this? Well, the answer is it's pretty flexible. You can do a lot of things with it. You'll come up with ideas, but a lot of them, like you say, they kind of sit off to the side. They're nice. They're cool demos. We're all amazed at what can be done with this new technology. But at the end of the day, we want to get business impact and deliver value. There, we say, let's flip it around. Let's don't say, okay, it's generative AI is cool. Where should we use it? We say, what are your problems? How can we make your business better? And often, the nature of process optimization is that you typically have a long backlog of things you'd like to do that accumulates over the years. And what we found is a lot of people have things that they've never really been able to address because it was technically too difficult. It wasn't the right time. And now with generative AI having changed the options that people have for automation, it's worth revisiting those things and saying, hey, you've been living with this for a while. You've expected, for example, that you needed human judgment at this point, or you needed hands on keyboard to do something. What if we can leverage generative AI here, again, as part of that core business process in order to help things? I think that's a much better conversation to have with people. From a technology perspective, it's also really beneficial because we think that a lot of the challenges people have with AI is a matter of trust and of, frankly, rigor, because to some degree it's non-deterministic in ways that we didn't see with previous technologies. I was talking earlier about we have many customers who say, it's the law, I have to do this. Well, let's not leave it up to the generative AI to do that. We'll structure that in with our processing, and then generative AI can give us some fluidity. We can use an AI agent at a place where we need to freelance a little bit, react to uncertain circumstances. We're not going to do that prescriptively. The AI can react to that in the moment, but then we'll still come back and make sure that we are using our scripted process to ensure that the right things are happening for regulatory compliance and legal compliance.
Matt, thank you for talking with me.
It's been great.